Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hills, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Al Gore has bowed out of the race for president in 2004. Democrats are surveying their options and starting to think about the qualities they need in a candidate for America's top job this time around. This hour, On Point, weighing the ideal ingredients in a Democratic candidate 2004 and asking how the early contenders shape up. We begin in Washington, where today President Bush rolled out plans for a new missile defense system. Limited initial deployment is set to begin within 2 years in time for the 2004 election. In a written statement, the president said the United States will take every measure to protect its citizens from, quote, catastrophic harm that may result from hostile states or terrorist groups armed with weapons of mass destruction and the means to deliver them. Bradley Graham covers the Pentagon for the Washington Post. I asked him why this plan and why now.
I think if the administration hoped to have a system deployed by the time of the next presidential election in 2004, President Bush needed to make a decision on what it would look like and how fast they would move ahead with it and what it would cost. So there were a number of decisions that had to be made for the fiscal 2004 budget that's going to be proposed to Congress in the next month or two. And I think that helped force a decision.
So is this primarily a campaign issue for the Bush administration or primarily a security issue?
Oh, I think it's primarily a security issue. You know, missile defense has always had a very large political dimension to it. I think the White House was hearing from the Pentagon that they were increasingly confident of their ability to field a very rudimentary system because some of the tests over the last year and a half or 2 years have gone generally well. So there was a desire by some of those in the Missile Defense Agency to move ahead faster rather than slower.
Bradley Graham, what is the advantage or effectiveness of a rudimentary system? What kind of weapons could it hypothetically knock down?
A system that would be based primarily in Alaska, as this one is envisioned to be, would be most useful against North Korean missiles, and North Koreans don't yet have a missile that can reach the United States, but they've been working very hard on one. So the idea would be to have these interceptors in place essentially to knock down a North Korean missile attack. Now, there are other elements to this layered system that the administration is talking about, including sea-based defenses that would defend against shorter-range missiles that might be launched from a ship or something. But the primary intercontinental threat at this point is from North Korea.
This system proposed is described as a limited system. Limited compared to what and how limited?
Well, it's limited compared to a system that would have many more interceptors and that would be able to shoot at an incoming missile at various stages of flight, shortly after the enemy missile is taken off and then as it's cruising through space and then as it's falling towards the United States. This system will only be aimed at the missile in mid-course, when it's arcing through space, and will include in 04 just 10 interceptors, and then in 05 another 10 for a total of 20 interceptors. Okay. And so if you assume that several interceptors will be launched at any incoming missile, it really, even by 2005, would at most have capability to defend against a handful of enemy missiles.
Pentagon assertions about the effectiveness of anti-ballistic missile systems have often been challenged in the past. How is the technical community receiving this announcement? Do people believe that this can be technically effective?
There's still quite a controversy about that, with a lot of experts thinking that the technology is still premature, that it really hasn't been proven. I mean, they demonstrated in principle a concept called hit-to-kill, which is basically using a missile to hit a missile.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what this system is based on. There are no explosives in the interceptor. It eliminates the enemy warhead just by crashing into it. That itself is very hard to do, and they've shown that under the simplest conditions they can do it. They haven't demonstrated that they can do it under more complex conditions of actual combat when the enemy missile might be accompanied by decoys. You're complicating the task of actually finding it in space.
Mm-hmm. And what is the price tag on this limited system supposed to be?
The administration's been spending a total of $8 billion a year on all its missile defense programs, and they're saying that for an additional $1.5 billion over the next 2 years, they'll be able to get this very rudimentary system of 20 interceptors in place.
So at this point, it looks in practice primarily as though it goes up in opposition to North Korea, in defense against North Korea. Is this primarily a strategic deterrent in that case, saying to North Korea, don't even try it because it might not work and you'll just be in more trouble?
Sure, there's that hope that it will be in place not just to defend against the United States if the North Koreans or somebody else would decide to launch a missile at the U.S., but that it will also dissuade North Koreans and other third world countries from pursuing development of long-range missiles, knowing that the United States is building this system that would likely knock down, or is said to anyway, have the capability to knock down any missile launch that the United States.
And finally, Bradley Graham, this is just a fraction of, I guess, what was envisioned in Ronald Reagan's Star Wars program, but does this put us on the path to a full Star Wars anti-missile defense system eventually, or could the U.S. still put this in place and then withdraw from the bigger vision?
It's certainly a step towards a more complex missile defense system. The Bush administration is not really talking about anything even years from now quite on the scale of what President Reagan initially envisioned. I mean, he was talking about a number of space-based elements as well as land and sea elements that would have been designed to guard against a massive attack from the Soviet Union. The Bush administration does talk about a layered system, but space-based weapons are really the least developed and farthest out on the drawing boards of the various designs that the administration has in mind down the road.
Bradley Graham, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Bradley Graham covers the Pentagon for The Washington Post and is author of Hit to Kill, The New Battle Over Shielding America from Missile Attack. He spoke to us earlier from Washington. George W. Bush is a popular president who will not, we learned this weekend, fight a rematch with Al Gore. So what would constitute the ideal Democratic candidate for president in 2004? Would-be contenders Lieberman, Edwards, Kerry, Daschle, Dean, and more are already milling at the gate. What mix of characteristics do Democrats need to have a real contest, a real debate with George W.? We're sitting down with two political consultants tonight, one Democrat, one Republican, to conjure up the perfect candidate profile and see how the shoe fits the early hopefuls. What kind of Democrat candidate could make a real race of it with George Bush in 2004? And who's got the goods? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now is Daniel Payne, a communications consultant to Democratic candidates and nonprofit organizations. Good evening and welcome, Dan Payne.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Good to have you. And Todd Domke, a media consultant to Republican candidates. Hello, Todd. Thanks for coming in.
Good to be with you.
So here we are. We know it's a bit of a parlor game, and the real game is already afoot, but it's still early enough on that we're trying to imagine the kind of potato head dynamic here of putting together the characteristics, the qualities, the positions, the profile of the ideal candidate in this time, in this election, to go up against George W. Bush. Dan Payne, take your first whack at it. What's the general profile that you think's needed? We'll stay out of the specific names for a moment here.
Well, let me give you my top three character traits or assets. First would be someone with a good moral character, no bimbos in the closet, mm-hmm. no draft dodging.
There's just no margin for that here.
No. In national politics, actually increasingly at every level of politics, you're not allowed to have made any mistake. Secondly, a bundle of dough. The primary campaign season in 2004 may last only 8 weeks. And at the beginning of that, you have California and New York, which are the most expensive media markets in the country. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have your own money, you're going to be in trouble, because even if you have the capacity to raise it, you may not be able to get it in fast enough to be able to use it in your own campaign.
So this is a very steep hurdle. You're saying you have to come with your own money. There's almost not time to raise it. That rules out almost everybody.
Or you have to have raised a substantial sum of money by the time the spending season is upon us. Yeah, and that means starting a campaign and raise money now.
Which is why we're talking about it now.
Right.
And number three.
Third is experience at the game. This is an extremely difficult emotional and physical course that presidential candidates have to run.
Mm-hmm.
If you haven't done it before, you have no idea how exhausted you are, how low you'll be on resources after you've been flying around the country for a couple of weeks.
And you mean all sorts of resources, from financial right down to spiritual.
Oh, absolutely. And just human resources. You know, do you know people in these little places where you have to have a campaign headquarters? Can you find somebody in Ottumwa, Iowa, who's for you and you can trust that they're going to stay for you?
To talk to in front of the camera. When you say experience at the game, must it be at the presidential campaign game, or can it be just a good experienced campaigner, whatever the position?
It's enormous help to have done it nationally at least one time. And if I had my druthers, I would look for a candidate there, just because it takes so much time to get used to it. And I remember when I was doing work with Dukakis in 1988, he talked about how exhausted he was, even during the primaries. You have to get up every week once the primaries start coming and rethink your whole campaign every single week.
And beyond. There's no break from it.
Don't contradict what you said in New Hampshire. When you go to Connecticut or when you drive out to New York State, you've got to be consistent, but you have to present a fresh face at every corner.
It's an incredible marathon. There is the Democratic consultant's top three: moral character, a bundle of dough, best of all your own, and experience at the game. Todd Domke, looking at it from the Republican point of view, we're asking you to be a bit generous tonight. Reach out and speak to the other side of the fence and say, here's what I think it would take to take on my man George W.
Okay, I'll try to exercise some compassionate conservatism here. I'll offer three as well.
Okay.
One is the right kind of personality. That's hard to define, but it does show up in resilience, as Dan just indicated.
Mm-hmm.
But I think perhaps the best indicator might be the sense of humor. That helps you to be resilient. It helps to win people over. It helps you to weather the storms. And it helps assure people that you have the kind of stable personality that can endure in times of crisis.
Does it have to be George W.'s brand?
No, I mean, not
you know,
at all.
He's got that kind of unflappable, even a bit removed, taking it easy even in the midst of the fray.
No, I don't think we can define the kind of humor. Just that it be genuine, as opposed to just crafted by jokemeisters who might give the candidate lines. There are a number of Democrats in the field right now who do have a genuine sense of humor. Second would be that it be the right type of leadership. And by that I mean, in this case, given the atmosphere out there now, given the post-9/11 reality, people want to be assured that there's real leadership, you know, executive-style leadership, as opposed to what a senator can do, for example, just saying, well, I cast the right votes. That's not enough. They have to know this person can take charge, can be commander-in-chief, as well as be someone who would help preside over the economy.
Of course, presidents have led in many different ways, in many different styles. There's no one style of leadership.
No,
is there?
But it has to be convincing that, as again, that he like Dukakis in the tank, you know, that old joke.
That photograph,
that undercut
not good.
Him because people then said, yeah, this guy, I don't see him as commander-in-chief.
So real leaders don't climb into tanks and wear funny hats.
Well, in his case, he didn't have the background that would suggest that he could be a great commander-in-chief, and that just sort of reinforced the point that was already being made about him.
And number three?
Number three would be the right message. Now, in this case, what's unique to the situation is that the Democrat needs a message that will unify Democrats, because it's going to be probably a pretty divisive primary situation over the next year. Appeal to independents, because in a number of key primaries, independents will be able to go in, not just registered Democrats to vote. So they're going to have to appeal to those independents, who a lot of times on reform-type issues. And that sometimes can clash with the traditional liberal message. So, and then finally, the right message in the sense that we didn't see it in the recent off-year elections where the Democrats did not have a clear economic strategy and they did not have a clear position on the prospect of war with Iraq.
We're going to come back and talk about whose foot this shoe might fit. How tall is the mountain, Todd Domke? How difficult a challenge?
I would say the odds are definitely in George Bush's favor, but it's possible.
And Dan Payne?
Oh, I think Bush's whole re-election depends on what happens in Iraq.
We'll talk about Iraq and the Democratic presidential candidates. We're looking for that ideal Democratic presidential candidate tonight. Gore's out, Bush is in. What will it take to make this a real race? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking about the ideal Democratic candidate. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
From Boston University.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the ideal Democrat presidential candidate 2004. Gore is out. Bush is in. What will it take to make a real race out of this race? What kind of Democrat candidate would make a real race of it with George Bush in 2004? What are the qualities that a real contender in this race needs? Will it take a liberal or a moderate to win or something else, something new? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight by two consultants, one a Democrat, Dan Payne, one a Republican, Todd Domke, looking at the kind of potato head game, if we're still can imagine at this stage in the game of putting together the ideal. We're going to look at the real live candidates who are sprouting up out there day by day. We went out of that segment with the war word, the other W word, looming large. Dan Payne, it's there already. It's on the horizon. You have to have a position already. How does a Democratic candidate deal with the war with Iraq? It's prospective at this point. By the time the election comes, it will, I'm sure George Bush hopes, be well over. Is it required, given how large national security will loom, that a Democrat be for the war? Can they be against the war? How do you read
it? Well, I think everyone will be for the war in some form, with varying degrees of support. Everyone is going to want to, in this era of 9/11 anxiety about national security, no candidate for president can afford to appear to be weak or vacillating. I think it was Bill Clinton who said it best. He said, you know, it's better to be strong and wrong than to be weak and right. So every Democrat will probably take some form of a support position. But this war is so complicated and the outcome so difficult to predict that I'm not sure that you're going to see the same people at the beginning of a war supporting it sort of in the middle and certainly a different cast of characters at the end. And so I think most Democrats will be smart enough to say, I'll support the president for now.
Todd Domke, the Republican perspective, where do you anticipate George W.'s vulnerability may be around the war? Is it all a win-win for him, or is there a window of vulnerability there as well?
Well, let's consider the options. And I'm sure the Democrats, even though I'm sure they did what their conscience told them to do,
of course,
that they also did calculate the political outcome. But there are only a few outcomes. One is that we win in the way that we won last time, that it's, you know, fairly easy, fairly quick, and, the use of overwhelming force, in which case those Democrats who did vote for the Iraq war resolution will be glad they did. The next would be if it was messy. But still, we'll win. We'll win this war one way or another. So it's not like Vietnam. It's not something that can drag on. So we'll win. If it's messy and there's all sorts of bad ramifications, maybe even to the economy, maybe to oil prices.
Too many body bags, oil markets a mess,
right,
terrorism at home.
Right. I hate to mention all of them. I've got kind of avoiding some of the particulars. Cause, then, obviously, some Democrat who did counsel against it or who kind of straddled by voting for the war resolution maybe but still was critical in raising doubts can say, see, I raised the questions. We shouldn't have done this unilaterally or whatever turns out to be the case. Most likely, though, it will be something that Democrats will hope will recede, that there'll be enough time between the victory and the election to where, like in Bush
like
Senior's
George
case.
George Senior.
Exactly. That it's not much of a factor. Because obviously being at war, obviously winning a war, generally favors the incumbent.
Dan Payne, we have a lot of senators in this race. What does that mean? Why? Why is that the fishing grounds this time?
Well, because every senator in the Capitol believes that he or she could do as good a job as the person in the White House.
Every senator, all the time, every year.
All the time, exactly. They talk about it. That's the one of their prime focuses every day is, did you see what President so-and-so did today? What a jerk. So they're all itching to get in there and show the world that they could be as good, at least as good, and probably better.
So, but there is a range from very centrist and moderate to more left or liberal leaning. What do you think is going to be the winning formula along that critical fulcrum or spectrum for Democrats, Dan Payne?
Probably somewhere in the middle, I guess. I would say the most hawkish position is probably held by Joe Lieberman.
Mm-hmm.
The most dovish position is held by former Governor Howard Dean,
mm-hmm.
who said he would not have voted for the resolution.
Wall Street Journal called him the updated Gene McCarthy.
Yes, and he could ride this to some early gain because there is plenty of anti-war activists still in the Democratic Party. And Dean in a New Hampshire primary where he can campaign next door from Vermont very effectively could score some points early on. Ditto in Iowa. Iowa's an anti-war state. And Dean could do well there also on an anti-war ticket.
All right. The names are starting to come in as they do. I want to reach out and ask Eleanor Clift to join us. She's a contributing editor for Newsweek magazine, joins us tonight from Washington, Eleanor?
Yes, that's right.
Thanks so much for being with us. Eleanor, you've heard some of this conversation, imagining the profile of the ideal candidate. You know what's actually out there in the field. Who's making the strongest early moves? Who seems to be in line with the kind of profile that our two consultants in studio tonight are drawing?
Well, I think the conventional wisdom in Washington is that the front runner status falls to John Kerry of Massachusetts, who really doesn't fit the profile that the consultants are drawing. He doesn't in some aspects. I mean, he's a strong, credible commander in chief, I think. He passes that threshold. But it's hard to imagine him appealing to independents. He does not have a moderate image. I think he's been working to moderate the liberal image, but coming from Massachusetts, that's hard.
Well, Dan Payne said moral character, bundle of dough, and experience at the game. Would those apply to John Kerry?
Yeah, I think the moral courage, he served commendably in Vietnam, mm-hmm. although he's not that popular with veterans because he ended up on the anti-war side after serving in Vietnam and being decorated for showing courage. Bundle of money, more than anybody else, he has access to money, I think, because of the state that he comes from and because of who he's married to, the widow of the Heinz ketchup fortune. But the name I just heard, Howard Dean, I think mm-hmm. he is also attracting interest for the very reasons that your consultant mentioned.
Is Washington taking him seriously?
Pardon me?
Is Washington taking Howard Dean seriously?
They're beginning to take him seriously. I think the general assessment is that he doesn't have the, quote, juice for the long run and that he might do well early on, but can he get the money and can he sustain? But he is following the script of the two Democrats who've been successful in recent years, a progressive, little-known governor from a small state. Of course, Vermont is smaller even than Arkansas, and Georgia looks like a powerhouse where Jimmy Carter came from.
But we've seen this formula work.
We have seen this formula work, exactly. And he has some things about him that are, socially conservative. He's a member of the NRA, which, could make him a little more acceptable in some of the rural areas where Democrats have not done well.
And got to thin those deer out in Vermont. Eleanor Clift, Dan Payne wants to jump in here with a question.
Eleanor, it seems every few years, every presidential election, there's a candidate that the press falls in love with. And frequently it's the person who doesn't really have much of a chance, but who is entertaining and has a courage of commitment, et cetera.
The John McCain factor.
Yeah. There are three of them have come from Arizona, in my experience. Mo Udall, Bruce Babbitt, and John McCain. I'm wondering if you think Howard Dean has the potential to be the candidate that the press falls in love with.
The charmed one.
I think he already is, and I have to confess, I met him a year ago, and I wrote I write a web column for Newsweek, and I felt like I discovered somebody. And he has that sort of McCain edginess about him. He gives you the feeling that he's going to tell you what he thinks regardless of the consequences. And, of course, I thought I had a very original insight. Every profile now you read of Dean points out the similarity to McCain.
Oh, they're all reading your clips, Eleanor. What about Joe Lieberman? Here he is. He stood back until Al Gore said, I'm not in. Is he a serious contender?
You know, I don't think so, and I really have to analyze myself as to why I think that. I mean, today I got in the mail a copy of his book, which is Reflections on the Presidential Campaign. He's pictured on the cover with his wife. I mean, they look like really old shoe types, like you could just curl up and nuzzle with both of them. But it's
well, there's
such
a characteristic.
A sappy book, I just think that... that Lieberman is a little too hawkish for the Democratic primaries on the war, and I think that he's pushing the family value thing a little bit too far for Democratic primary activists. I guess that's my conclusion.
Todd Domke, jump in here. What about the Democratic primaries this time? Looking from the Republican point of view, independents, you mentioned, are going to play a larger role. Why and where?
Well, in certain key states like California, where there's an open primary, then independents can come in. And if there's no contest on the Republican side, as we imagine, mm-hmm. who knows? Maybe some Republicans would like to re-register to go where the action is.
Does that make a hawkish Joe Lieberman better positioned?
Well, yes and no. I think of him more as a front runner now. It might just be temporary. It might just be because he's sort of an heir apparent. He has the better name.
He was on the ticket.
Name recognition and all that. But he also has an affable way about him that people – he seems real. He seems substantive. He's not slick. As I said, he has a good sense of humor. So I think he's definitely out there at the beginning. But I don't know. I think that the press were starting to fall in love with John Kerry, but that was partly with the idea of, okay, there has to be an alternative to Al Gore, and we have to start coalescing around that to make this a contest. And I think that's kind of gone now. I mean, it doesn't mean that John Kerry's out of it by any means, but mm-hmm. but I think he had some momentum going there now that I think is gone.
Eleanor Clift, George W. Bush is a particular candidate at a particular moment, maybe a moment with a war in the middle of it. Where do you hear people talking about the vulnerabilities, the open window that Democrats might go after him through?
Oh, I think the economy is the big issue, and is he going to be able to revive the economy? Is a war with Iraq going to put further pressure on the economy? And, you know, I think nobody doubts that a war with Iraq is winnable, if not in 100 hours, you know, mm-hmm. certainly in 100 days. But where does that leave us afterwards? You know, the caretakers in the Middle East, and what are the repercussions? So, I mean, it's kind of a terrible thing that Democrats have to consider, that it will take a calamity to get George W. Bush out of office. But when you look at all of the imponderables out there, there's lots of room for calamity on both domestic and the foreign policy.
Lots of room for evolution on both fronts. You're quite right. Listeners, who among these early contenders has got the goods? Who has the winning profile, positions, appeal? You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. Matt's calling from Newton, Massachusetts. Hi, Matt. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks.
I'm wondering how your guests would respond to two additional potential factors
okay.
in a resume. One, military background. Mm-hmm. Two, geography, namely someone from the South or West. Wouldn't those two factors be of significant help? And I have another question, if you'll allow me another at a later moment.
Sure, let's take that one up first. Eleanor, geography, military background, how key?
Oh, I think it's key because George W. Bush now, like it or not, is taken very seriously in this country as a commander-in-chief, although he came into office with little or no experience in foreign policy. And so you have to have somebody to go toe-to-toe with him. And if the Democrats could get a candidate from the West, or again, a figure from the South, I mean, John Edwards is out there, but he's only a freshman senator in
South Carolina.
Concerned that he's a little... too light for the job this soon into his political career. But, you know, Northeastern Democrats don't do well in the South, and, you know, Western Democrat might fare much better. I just don't know who that person might be.
And, Matt, your other question or comment?
How would your guests feel about this as a potential message in 2004 for the Democrats? You don't have to give up your civil liberties. You don't have to give up your environment. You don't have to give up your job in order to be safe and secure. You can have both.
You can have a chicken and the pot. Dan Payne, what about it?
Well, it depends on how much money it's going to cost to do a war and all those other things, because judging from the results of the last election, it seems voters first want to feel safe. And that, unfortunately, is going to wind up being a play to the advantage of the Republicans and George Bush in particular. I think military experience, to go back to your question earlier, is very important. I think it's probably catapulted Kerry into, if not front-runner status, at least one of the leading candidates, because he can argue
his Vietnam service.
Yeah, and he can put together, you know, a number of clear sentences on foreign and military policy. He can also bring the campaign. His might be the last Vietnam campaign we have in this country. His versus Bush, if we have that out. Bush was a draft dodger. Kerry was a war hero. And this may make George Bush less of a heroic figure in a time of war. It's doubtful to me that you try to turn that on that basis. But the other thing I would say is that it's the South is so important to the Democrats that no Northern Democrat has won the White House since John Kennedy. So Democrats have to be mindful of the geography of all their candidates.
And Eleanor Clift, what about this issue of the economy, the environment? Is it possible that the Republicans could be seen in the thrall of a kind of security overkill? Or is there such a thing as too much emphasis on security, do you think, coming into this next election?
I mean, if we don't have any, you know, terrorist attacks on our soil, if the Iraq war passes kind of, you know, uneventfully, and the president is still out there, you know, talking, you know, war and scaring people or trying to scare people, and the country may not buy it anymore. I mean, they may relax and focus on other issues. I mean, we do have a health care mess in this country, and I think that's where Howard Dean in particular has an opening as a physician. And he really has done good things in Vermont, although it is a small, homogeneous state. But, you know, he's got ideas, and I think, you know, there are other primaries that go on, and the ideas primary is one of them, and I think Dean is well-positioned there.
Matt, thanks for your call. Catherine's calling from Cedar Grove, Wisconsin. Excuse me. Hi, Catherine. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I really, you know, I hear a lot about what do the Democrats have to do, what do the Republicans have to do. And I just kind of wanted to comment and maybe get some feedback on this, but I really have seen, or not seen, rather, that I've seen a lack of patriotism in our politicians and in our presidential candidates. I hear a lot about foreign policy and what we can do for other countries, but I think, you know, just now a good comment was made. You know, we do have other issues. We have the fact that our schools need a lot of help. We have the health care issue. We have unemployment rates, and our economy is just awful. And I just kind of want to see, you know, what do your guests think about the potential for a candidate who is more a patriot than
so you're defining patriotism on the home front, Catherine. Thanks for your call. Eleanor Clifton, we have to let you go in a second, but can Democrats do that? Can they turn this around and say real patriotism is about health care, the economy, Social Security, not just about fighting wars?
Yeah, I wouldn't want to introduce, you know, who's patriotic and who isn't, but I think Democrats shouldn't be afraid to be, you know, critical of the Bush foreign policy, and they shouldn't be afraid to say that, you know, a country needs to be strong within as well. But I get real nervous when you start discussing who's a real patriot and who isn't. I think they should stay away from that.
Well, everyone's going to be red, white, and blue one way or another. Eleanor Clift, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Eleanor Clift is contributing editor for Newsweek magazine. We're talking about the ideal Democratic presidential candidate 2004. What issues should top the agenda of the ideal candidate? Who's turning your head so far? Are you even ready to think about it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
From Boston University.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. It's early days, but we are talking about the ideal Democratic presidential candidate for 2004 tonight. Gore is out. Bush is in. What will it take to make a real race out of this? Do you see a winner in Lieberman, Edwards, Kerry, Dean, Daschle, Gebhardt, Hillary? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-8255. 423-TALK. My guests tonight are two political consultants, Daniel Payne for the Democrats, Todd Domke for the Republicans. You can join us as well. David's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
Democrats, and there are three potential candidates here. Lieberman and Kerry, I mean, we're looking at, I think, baggage with regard to the accounting rules, which I think Lieberman led the charge in the change there. Didn't Kerry have a little massacre incident in his background? So as a Republican, I look totally forward to exposing that baggage.
Well, that's been highly disputed and pretty much put behind him at this point, I think. But
well, yeah, but it can be thrown open again under the full glare of the media spotlight during a campaign. Now, as far as Dean goes, who? The governor of what state? I mean, I'm calling from the Midwest. He's just not going to play. But speaking as a Republican and also from a Machiavellian point of view, I don't know why the Democrats don't go back and look at the Clinton films. The guy was a masterful politician, and he burned us on so many occasions by simply just ripping us off.
So is there another one, or will one of the candidates that's out there step into the Republican agenda? David, thanks for your call. Todd Domke, do you think there's room for the Republicans to be Clintonized this time? Is there a room for a Democrat to come in and steal Republican thunder? Can that still work?
Well, I don't think in this case, because the thunder now is the war against terror, the war against Iraq, tax cuts. And I don't see how the Democrats all of a sudden are going to try to plagiarize on any of those. It was different before where he co-opted a few issues where he tried to be, you know, as conservative on crime and where he finally went along with welfare reform after it was
the era of big government is over.
That's right. But no, I don't think that option's there. And I think a lot of Democrats feel that they did poorly this last go-round because they didn't offer a clear alternative message.
Dan Payne.
The point about Howard Dean, nobody knows who he is. Nobody knew who Jimmy Carter was. And not very many people knew who Bill Clinton was before he scored a saving second place in New Hampshire. Howard Dean is a very interesting candidate. I mean, he can come at the Democratic candidates or his opponents from right and left. He's the pro-gun candidate, tough on taxes and spending in Vermont as governor, yet he is a strong believer in single payer. He signed the only gay marriage law in the country. He has the probably the best credentials outside of politics of any of them, I mean, in terms of a medical career. He's a very interesting candidate, and he doesn't have to have very much money. He can drive, 50 miles, and he'll be in New Hampshire.
And does he come across as bigger than his small northeastern state?
I think when he talks about health care and bigger issues, he does. He ran a deficit-free administration in Vermont, and he's been tough on spending. He has an interesting profile for this. And the point about Clinton, there was a poll done that just came out today by the Marist organization in New York State, and they looked at where the Clinton voters went based on who's in the race now. And Joe Lieberman, who had 23% of the vote in that poll, this is in New York State only, and John Kerry had 20. Let's stick with those two. The Clinton voters, 31% went to Lieberman and 10% went to Kerry. So for now anyway, the Clinton voters think of Lieberman as the logical inheritor of the mantle of Clinton policies.
In the centrism of his position, you're saying?
Yes, and just the association, the fact that he is, you know, he was close to Gore and Gore was close to Clinton. You know, there's a kind of loose confederation of familiarities there.
What about in style or rhetorical capacity? Who do you see among the Democratic contenders who can take the nation, the world situation, and wrap it up with that kind of finesse that Bill Clinton could, that many people found so compelling?
Well, I think John Kerry is a good orator. He tends to be a little bit formal, but he certainly has wowed people in the past with speeches. John Edwards, senator from North Carolina, young man, is a terrific trial attorney, a good speaker. Gephardt, who has a kind of Midwestern bearing, not surprisingly, since he's from Missouri. Yeah, I've seen him when he's wound up give terrific speeches. I don't know about some of the others. I don't know whether or not Tom Daschle's capable of stirring a crowd, or Howard Dean, for that matter. But Democrats can score in the speechifying department as needed.
Todd Dumpke, a rhetorical threat out there?
Well, not necessarily. It's one thing to wow an audience in what's a prepared intellectual kind of speech, you know, at a university or something. John Kerry has not shown the ability, though, to inspire an audience in the sense of oratory. The most theatrical in that group that we haven't talked about is Al Sharpton. He speaks in sound bites. It's true that, you know, in a lot of cases he doesn't make total sense, but he is the most theatrical.
And he's a declared candidate. I guess when you bring up Al Sharpton, it brings up the Trent Lott issue as well. Todd Dumpke, is this still going to be hanging around in 2004? Are Republicans lancing that wound right now, or is it still going to be there?
I believe this will be over before the January 6th Republican conference. And by the way,
Senator Lott, no longer majority leader in the Senate.
That's exactly right. But back to Al Sharpton, if I may. I would just make one point here about him, because I think he will be sort of the same problem Trent Lott is for the Republicans now. The black vote is very important to the Democrats. It's it's very large, and
it used
especially
to be important to the Republicans.
Well, I know,
until Trent Lott.
No, but I'm saying in the Southern presidential primaries and the Democratic primaries, in many cases you're talking about 40+% are the black vote.
And you think that the Sharpton voice will be alienating?
He will be something of a power broker. And how do they deal with him? He speaks to that one thing that most matters to most liberal Democrats: indignation. That's his language. And
Dan Payne, how far will Al Sharpton go?
Oh, he'll go through the New York primary, and I don't know if he'll be able to sustain it after that. In the poll I was just referring to, he was in second place. Lieberman was at 23, and he was at he was in third place. Kerry was at 20, and Sharpton was at 14.
In New York State.
In New York State.
But the country's a bigger stage. Jerry's on the line. Hi, Jerry. You're on the air.
Hi. How you doing?
Fine, thanks, Jerry.
Good. I'm less concerned about which Democratic candidate gets nominated I'd like to find the Democrats as a whole attack the Republicans on policy issues.
So what's the line of attack you would like to see them take, Jerry?
Oh, there's a number of lines of attack. In terms of the first thing that comes to mind is in terms of the tax issues. The Republicans have been saying for years that the Democratic Party is the party of tax and spend. And, you know, George Bush has been saying lower taxes, Republicans say lower taxes. Mm-hmm. I don't see that they're really lowering taxes, at least not my taxes.
Well, they're cutting taxes, but it may not be yours if you're not.
That's right. And they're increasing
more,
the deficit in the meantime. And they're increasing the deficit in the meantime.
Yes.
Which means that tax bill is going to come due. And guess who's going to be shouldering a bigger share of the burden when that happens?
Jerry, we've got your point, and our time's running down. I want to put it to Dan Payne. Dan Payne, Jerry's saying, make the big, aggressive attack case against the Republicans. What is that? What's the stand-up? What are the big elements that you say, we want to reframe the conversation along Democratic lines? How does an effective candidate do that this time out?
Well, one of the ironies of the situation is that the deficit could wind up being an issue that Democrats would campaign on. Mm-hmm. That it's grown. It continues to grow. The Bush tax cut is going to make it grow even larger. A sagging economy is going to increase the size of the deficit. It could wind up being a very powerful card in the Democratic hands. I also think health care is an issue that periodically comes back. We're now at a point in this country where we have an aging population. Mm-hmm. The pressures on the health care system are enormous. We don't have any options before us right now. We have these nickel-dime things about prescription drugs and eyeglasses for the elderly and things like that. But we don't have any serious rethinking of the health care system, and that's what we need.
And it's huge. Todd Dumpke, for the Republicans, who do you think the GOP will most fear, or what line of attack? If the war goes well, if that one piece goes well, where are Republicans worried?
You mean on what issue or by what candidate?
Well, take a piece of each.
If we suffer a double-dip recession, which we're all hoping to avoid, some of the Democrats don't sound like they're hoping as much as the rest of us, that would obviously make Bush more vulnerable. But I don't think any of the Democrats have any great credibility in terms of saying, oh, yes, I know how to turn an economy around, and especially when their main prescription for the economy is to raise taxes. I think practically everyone realizes that doesn't help the economy. It hurts the economy.
Well, we'll see who steps up and with what message they step up. Todd Domke, communications consultant to the Republican world, thank you for joining us tonight. And Dan Payne, communications consultant to the Democratic side, thanks a lot for being with us. Great to have you. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, we go on a spacewalk with the first Native American in orbit. This is On Point. On December 7th, after a 14-day visit to the International Space Station, the space shuttle Endeavour returned to Earth. One of the seven crew members on board was astronaut John Harrington, the first Native American ever to travel into space. In this radio diary, John Harrington reflects on his historic journey and recounts his experience, starting with his spacewalk.
It was a fabulous experience. It was really more than I dreamed about. The sense of both touch, the sound of the fan and the helmet, and just the visual cues from the Earth were just phenomenal. One of the things that a friend of mine told me to do was to ingrain a picture in your mind that would stay with you the rest of your life, even not from just a photo, but something you'll remember from being there. And that was when I came to the top of the P1 truss. You know, to me, it was like cresting the ridge in a mountain range and just seeing the world spread out before you and arcing from all the way from my right all the way to my left. And on the left side was the Russian segment of the space station. So it was seeing both the Earth and then the technology was fantastic. The image that I, when I crested the top of that and I looked down and saw that it was just the most beautiful blue and white, and you could see the horizon and how thin our atmosphere is. Yeah, that's going to live with me for the rest of my days. What I brought with me on the flight in terms of Native American objects was some eagle feathers, about six of those. I had a flute that I had flown, and also a couple of arrowheads. And one of the arrowheads was from my father. The other was from an aunt who had found it on the base of a dry lake up around Bartlesville, Oklahoma. And so the thought about that to me was how amazing it was that when the person had made that arrowhead years ago, to imagine where it would be at one point sometime in the future. So that was really neat. I also had some sweetgrass, a braided sweetgrass. Also a piece of a rock that came from Bear Butte in South Dakota. That was very important to me. It came from a very good friend who had been there numerous times. And at one point in my training, I wanted to get up there and have a chance to go up and just spend the weekend and enjoy the spiritualness of being there. Never had the opportunity to do that. Now I was able to fly a piece of that. Also a piece of rock that came from the Crazy Horse Monument in South Dakota. Certainly for the eagle feathers, you know, hold the eagle in the highest esteem, being that the eagle flies closest to the Creator. So we have a lot of reverence for the eagle. And having be able to take a feather to a place where, you know, so it could look back down on the world, and Mother Earth was real inspirational for me, and I think it means a lot to a lot of folks that have that same reverence. I think everybody in the Native American community can identify with that, and that's the purpose behind doing that. Here is something that they can identify with now, whereas before they might not have identified with the space program. Now they have a direct connection to it. The fact that we actually waved off gave me a chance to really sit back, take a deep breath, and say, okay, let's really appreciate where we're at. Because for the first portion of the mission, you were just constantly working. It's just, you're nonstop. Boom, 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 boom. But there is an opportunity to take a breath and to float up and look out the windows and watch the night lights pass by. I saw London and the whole coast of England, and the next second, man, I'm looking at Paris. It's like going camping with seven of your best friends. When we docked, and the name of the vehicle was Endeavour, and there's a good picture of us docking on the way to the space station over Cook Strait in New Zealand, and I think it was First Lieutenant James Cook was the captain of the Endeavour, sailed through those straits back in the 1700s. So to superimpose the Endeavour over a place where the Endeavour, the ship, had sailed, you know, hundreds of years ago, I mean, that says a lot for what we're capable of doing.
John Harrington is the first Native American space traveler. For more information on him and his mission, you can visit our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Cassettes and CDs of On Point are available for $15. Go to onpointradio.org or call 1-800-909-9287.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners.